Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam. Dear listeners, Radio Sai continues its weekly presentation of the talking book version of Mr. Howard Moffat's highly acclaimed book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The author was among the very early Westerners who came to Satya Sai Baba as a skeptic in 1964, and drawn by his enigma, he stayed for considerable periods of time near him in the next 6 years. During this period, he conducted extensive research and probing investigations into the Sai phenomena. He published his findings as the book that has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer which introduced Sri Satya Sai Baba to millions round the world. This book was first published in 1971. Since then, it has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the loving path of Satya Sai. These readings, dear listeners, are being aired every week, and if you wish to revisit a chapter at any time, you can do so at our website radiosai.org. So dear listeners, welcome now to Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Moffat.
Sai Ram, and welcome to this talking book session of excerpts from Mr. Howard Moffat's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. We are now at the second half of chapter 17, titled, Two Preeminent Devotees. In the previous segment, the author profiled the experiences of an eminent devotee, Dr. Ramakrishna Rao. In the latter half, the author introduces us to the man who is considered a giant among the scientists of his time, Dr. S. Bhagwantam, a scientist of high caliber, was a former director of the All India Institute of Science and held a prominent position of scientific advisor to the Ministry of Defense in Delhi. He was very well known in scientific circles outside of India when Mr. Moffat had met him. Here is the story of how the skeptical scientist found and accepted the spiritualist.
When I met him at Prashanti Nilayam, he was occupying a room furnished only with two bedrolls and a few cushions on the floor. Like all good Indians, he was quite happy to use the tiled floor as bedstead, chair, and table. With him in the same room was one of his sons, Dr. S. Balakrishna, Assistant Director of the National Geographical Research Institute of India. Both were visiting the ashram for a few days. I sat on the floor with these two cultured scientists and charming gentlemen, anxious to hear of their experiences with Sai Baba. Outside the open door and windows, the July sun gleamed on the sandy soil, white buildings, and rocky hills. Inside, Dr. Bhagavantam spoke in his quiet, friendly, concise way, while his son confirmed many of the strange events, which he too had witnessed. Dr. Balakrishna has had some wonderful experiences of his own with Baba, but here we are concerned with the remarkable reports from his eminent father. At Dr. Bhagavantam's first meeting with Sai Baba, which was in the year 1959, they went for a walk on the sands of the Chitravati River. Others were present, but Bhagavantam was walking by the side of Baba. After a while, Swami asked him to select a place on the sands for sitting down. When the doctor hesitated, Baba insisted, explaining that only in this way could Bhagavantam's scientific mind be quite sure that Baba had not led him to a spot where an object had been planted in the sands. After the scientist had chosen an area and the party was seated on the sands, Baba began to tease the doctor a little. He made fun of the complacent, all-knowing attitude of many men of science and deplored their ignorance of or indifference to the ancient wisdom to be found in the great Hindu scriptures. The doctor's pride was stung. He retorted that not all scientists were of this materialistic outlook. He himself, as an example, had a family tradition of Sanskrit learning and a deep interest in the spiritual classics of India. Then, in an endeavor to establish the bona fides of his scientific colleagues, he told Baba that when Oppenheimer, after exploding the first atom bomb, was asked by the press representatives what his reactions were, he replied by quoting a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, thus showing that he was a student of that great work. "Would you like a copy of the Bhagavad Gita?" Baba asked him suddenly, scooping up a handful of sand as he spoke. "Here it is," he continued. "Hold out your hands." Bhagavantam cupped his hands to catch the sand as Baba dropped it into them. But when it reached the scientist's waiting palms, it was no longer the golden sand of the Chitravati. It was a red-covered book. Opening it in stunned silence, the doctor found that it was a copy of the Bhagavad Gita printed in Telugu script. Baba remarked that he could have presented the doctor with one printed in Sanskrit, but as the latter read Sanskrit script with some difficulty, Baba had given him one in Telugu, Bhagavantam's native tongue. Bhagavantam had not mentioned his limited proficiency in Sanskrit. This was something that Baba just knew. As soon as he could, Bhagavantam examined this miraculously produced volume closely. It appeared to be quite new and was well printed. But where? The names of printer and publisher, always given in the normal way, were nowhere to be found. One day in 1960, Sai Baba was visiting the great scientist's home in Bangalore. At this time, Dr. Bhagavantam was director of the All India Institute of Science in that city. He had known Sai Baba for about a year and was struggling to make the incredible phenomena he had witnessed fit in with his scientific training. He said on one occasion at a public meeting, "I was a fairly lost person at that time, for all this was an utter contradiction to the laws of physics for which I stood and still stand. Having learned the laws of physics in my youth and having taught others for many, many years thereafter about the inviolability of such laws, at least so far as any known human situation is concerned, and having put them into practice with such a belief in them, I naturally found myself in a dilemma." One of Dr. Bhagavantam's sons, at this time a boy of about 11 years, seemed to be mentally retarded. Some medical men had recommended as treatment the piercing of the lumbar region of the spine to remove cerebrospinal fluid and so relieve pressure on the brain. Others had been against such treatment, saying that it would only make the boy worse. Dr. Bhagavantam had decided not to have it done. Baba, who loves and understands children, saw the boy and asked a sympathetic question about him. The scientist began to talk about his son's case, and then Baba took over the narration and himself related all that had happened, including the medical debate about the advisability of a lumbar puncture. He went on to say that this would, in fact, would do no harm, but on the contrary would help the boy, making him appreciably better as time went on. Then casually, as if it were nothing at all, he said that he would himself do the puncture then and there. The scientist was startled. Doubt and fear agitated his mind. He began to wonder about things like professional qualifications for such an operation. But before he could utter a word, Baba had waved his hand and materialized some vibhuti. Uncovering the boy's back, he rubbed the sacred ash on the lumbar region. Next, with another hand wave, he took from the air a hollow surgical needle about 4 inches long. The father felt himself in the presence of a power so far beyond his understanding that he could say nothing. He just waited, watched, and hoped for the best. The boy seemed to be semi-conscious, apparently anesthetized by Baba's vibhuti. Without hesitation, Baba inserted the needle, showing that he knew the precise spot at which such insertions must be made. To the watching father, the needle seemed to go right in, out of sight, and he began to worry about how it would be recovered. Meantime, Baba was massaging the back and removing the fluid that came out through the needle. "He seemed to take away about 1 cubic centimeter of this fluid," the scientist said. Then, massaging more strongly or in a different way, Baba brought the needle out of the boy's back. He held it in the air as if handing it to some invisible nurse. Immediately it vanished. "Have you a surgical dressing?" Baba then asked the watching spellbound people in the room. Bhagavantam, another of his sons called Ramakrishna, and a friend named Shastri, who was a Sanskrit pundit. Young Ramakrishna replied saying that by phoning the institute, he could get a dressing within 10 minutes. Too long, Baba laughed, waving his hand again and taking a dressing of the right type as if from a trained assistant in another dimension. Carefully, he arranged it on the boy's back and then brought him around to full consciousness. The patient seemed to suffer no pain or discomfort, either during or after the operation. "And is he any better?" I asked the good doctor. "Yes, his condition has improved, though not remarkably," he replied cautiously. "But who knows what he would have been like without the operation? Swami says that he will go on improving as he grows older." Dr. Bhagavantam has seen Baba produce many things by his magical hand wave. These include medicines in bottles and other packs, properly sealed but without any name of the maker marked on them. He has seen Baba change one stone or decorative figure set in jewelry to another of an entirely different character, simply by stroking his finger across the face of it. The relevant item of jewelry did not for a moment disappear from view during such operations. Once he saw Baba produce Amrita in a container which the physicist estimated from his experience of capacities would hold enough for about 50 people, each receiving the spoonful which Baba doled out. In fact, though, Baba fed about 500 people with the ambrosial liquid, which apparently was miraculously increased to 10 times its original volume. On another occasion, the doctor was sitting with a group of devotees around Baba on a beach in southern India. The talk turned to the various names by which the ocean had been known in Indian mythology. Someone mentioned the name Ratnakara, which means, he said, Lord of Diamonds or Precious Stones. In that case, Baba remarked playfully, "The ocean should produce some diamonds for us." Putting his hand in the water, he took out a sparkling diamond necklace. Everybody was enthralled at the sight of this circlet of large stones, and someone asked Baba to wear it. Bhagavantam could see plainly that it would not go over Baba's head, being too small and apparently without a clasp for opening the necklace. But such problems did not bother the miracle man. He simply pulled it outward with both hands as one would stretch a rubber ring. It increased to the right size, yet there were no gaps between the stones. Then to please his devotees, Baba put on this diamond garland from Ratnakara over his head and wore it on his neck for a short time. Dr. Bhagavantam has also had his own personal experience of Sai Baba's faculty of knowing what is taking place thousands of miles away without benefit of telegraph or radio. When Dr. S. Balakrishna, Bhagavantam's son, moved into a new house in Hyderabad, Baba agreed to go there and perform a house blessing ceremony. The auspicious day for the ritual was named by Baba, and he promised to come on that day. Dr. Bhagavantam was himself away on a government mission to Moscow, but he was scheduled to be back in Hyderabad on the morning of the day of the ceremony, which was to take place in the afternoon. However, engine trouble in the aeroplane by which he was returning developed somewhere near Tashkent, and he was forced to spend the night in that city. This was the night before the ceremony, and Baba, who was at Balakrishna's house in Hyderabad, informed the family that there was engine trouble and that Dr. Bhagavantam was spending the night at Tashkent, but would be flying on to Delhi the following day. No one else in the area knew that there had been any trouble with the plane or that Bhagavantam was at Tashkent. No word of this had come through ordinary channels. But Baba had his own way of knowing and also of foreseeing that the fault would be righted by the following day. In the afternoon of the auspicious day, as prearranged, Sai Baba carried out the house blessing ceremony. During this, he produced in his usual miraculous manner a beautiful statuette of Shirdi Baba, which the two scientists informed me is about 3 inches in height and seems to be of solid gold. Baba said it was to be kept in the shrine room of the Hyderabad house where it was materialized, and there it is still. All felt sorry that the head of the family, Dr. Bhagavantam, could not be present at the important ceremony, and that evening they talked about where he might perhaps be spending his time. "Was he back in Delhi?" they asked Baba. "Yes," the latter told them, and he was at that moment in the office of the Minister of Defense, New Delhi. Then Baba booked a telephone call to the minister's office, making it a personal call to the scientific advisor, Dr. Bhagwantam. At that period, I am told, there was always a considerable delay for a trunk call over such a long distance. But Baba's call came through in a few minutes. Dr. Bhagwantam was at the office, as Swami had stated. He was closeted with the minister and in the middle of an important conference. The minister had in fact given strict instructions to his staff that he was not to be interrupted, no matter who telephoned or called to see him. Nevertheless, and no one knows why, one of the secretaries did interrupt him to say that there was a phone call from Hyderabad for Dr. S. Bhagwantam. With the minister's concurrence, the doctor left the room and took the call. Then Swami's sweet voice was in his ear, telling him that all had gone well at the house blessing. Baba elated him further by saying that he would remain in Hyderabad with the family until Bhagwantam returned on the morrow. With joy in his heart and renewed spirit, the scientist went back to discuss his country's defense problems with the minister responsible in those days, V.K. Krishnamenon. When I asked Dr. S. Bhagwantam if I could use his name in support of the incredible things he had told me, he promptly answered, "Yes, I will stand behind every word of it." The earlier dilemma, the conflict between his scientific training and the evidence of his senses, has been resolved. He says, "In our laboratories, we scientists may swear by reason, but we know that every time we have added a little to what we know, we have known of the existence of many other things, the true nature of which we do not know. In this process, we become aware of further large areas to understand which we have to struggle more. Thus, while adding to knowledge, we add more to our ignorance too. What we know is becoming a smaller and smaller fraction of what we do not know." He goes on to say, "Sai Baba transcends the laws of physics and chemistry, and when he transcends a law, that fact becomes a new law. He is a law unto himself." Once in Madras, addressing an audience of some 20,000 people who had come to hear Sai Baba's message, the worthy doctor said, "Scientists are aware that knowledge is not the same as wisdom. Wisdom has to be got from Bhagwan and the likes of him who come among us from time to time for this express purpose. He is a phenomenon. He is transcendental. He is divine. He is an incarnation. He is our nearest kith and kin. Turn to him for the eternal message. That alone can save us."
Mind-blowing experiences indeed. This brings us to the end of Chapter 17, in which the author, Mr. Murfitt, showcased the experiences of two preeminent devotees, Dr. Ramakrishna Rao and Dr. Bhagwantam. Why did he dedicate an entire chapter to these two men? Maybe because their professional qualifications and positions in the society would qualify them as men in whom the larger society would have put their trust and faith, and they in turn trusted Swami. Well, that is all from us today in this session. More when we meet the next time. Till then, all the best and Jai Sai Ram. You have been listening to a presentation of excerpts from Mr. Howard Murfitt's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. This book has been published in 1971 by Frederick Miller Limited in London.